Radio, your right to know. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr. Rights Radio is brought to you by RightsRadio.com and by our publishing house, StarPublications.com. That's Star with two R's, books that empower and inspire. Our topic today is Voice of the Voiceless and Defender for All Animals, the wonderful work of the Houston Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals, the Houston SPCA. The Houston SPCA is featured in the Animal Planet cable show entitled Animal Cops Houston. We have a very unusual program today, a full panel discussion with leading experts of the Houston SPCA. And let me introduce our first panelist, Mira Nandlal, Public Relations Manager of the Houston SPCA and Panel Coordinator. Welcome, Mira.
Hi, how are you?
Great, and I want to thank you for your fantastic efforts in organizing this program.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to do it.
Mira, can you begin by providing an overview of the Houston SPCA? When was it founded, and what are your primary objectives?
Well, the Houston SPCA was founded in 1924 as a shelter for women and children, and soon after that it began to take in horses who had been mistreated on the carriage rides in downtown Houston. Then it became a shelter for women, children, and their pets, and today we carry on that same tradition of taking care of pets involved in a domestic situation with our Pet Safe program. Now, the mission of the Houston SPCA is to promote commitment to and respect for all animals and to free them from suffering, abuse, and exploitation, and for more than 84 years, the Houston SPCA has been an open door, a safe haven, and defender for all animals.
That's beautiful. How do you raise all the funds you need to do the job?
Well, we have lots of different ways. Of course, people can donate to the Houston SPCA all through the year, and of course, we take supplies for all the animals. We take monetary donations. There's food that people donate. We also have lots of large events, and our pet telethon we just had, it was our 14th annual. We raised over $300,000. That happened just on August 23rd, and on the very same day, 281 animals got adopted, so that was great. Also, we have something coming up called the Mutt Strut. There's our annual gala, and then we do a variety of community outreach programs that include mobile adoptions at events such as the Houston Astros games. We've been to the Comets games and special pet festivals all around town.
Can you give the phone number and URL in case anybody wants to contact you after our program?
The number is 713-869-7722, and the website is HoustonSPCA.org.
Beautiful. Our first panelist that you've provided for us today is George Ortega, Vice President of Shelter Services for the Houston SPCA. Welcome, George.
Good morning.
Great. George is going to be speaking today about animal cruelty. And, George, examples of animal cruelty abound, and your resources are obviously limited, yet it appears from our television reports that you try to help almost every injured animal rescued. Is that the case?
Yes, ma'am, it is. We try to respond to every report we get, whether it's a animal cruelty report or whether it's an injured animal report. Just in the month and so far of 2008, we've been able to respond to 2,300 injured animal reports, and cruelty investigations, we tend to see on average about 10 to 11,000 reports in a year.
Well, isn't there a financial cap on what you're able to spend? How are you able to afford all that excellent service?
Well, we are able to continue our services due to the great support of our community. We have great supporters who continue to contribute and support that program, and specifically, especially cruelty investigations and injured animal rescue, which allows us to go out there and just be that voice for the voiceless and help out those animals in need.
What happens when an animal, let it be a horse or a dog or even a cat, requires extensive and repeated surgeries? Do you have highly trained specialists who contribute their services and time? And if so, can you share several examples?
Certainly. We have a great staff of veterinarians on hand. We have four staff veterinarians here who are highly trained in different fields, who can handle anything from companion animals to farm animals. We also have a great network of veterinary clinics, of both special clinics, specialty clinics being like equine clinics, or just companion animal clinics. We have a strong working relationship with VCA Animal Hospitals, who take care of our companion animals. And then we have a good working relationship with Gulf Coast Equine Clinic down in Southeast Houston, who also helps us with these specialty cases when it has to do with horses. Each animal is evaluated individually. It depends on the age, the situation, the prognosis, the recovery, and what the animal needs to live a healthy life. And we here at the Houston SPCA, we team up, get all our experts together, we individually evaluate each animal, and then we determine should we continue on treatments or surgeries or any special care that each animal might need.
Would that include the discovery of cancer, for example? It might be an injured animal, but then you discover that it also has cancer. Would you be able to attempt to treat it for cancer if possible?
No, we don't have those facilities available to us in the shelter. What we would be treating for and caring for are the immediate needs, for example, open lacerations, broken legs, embedded collars, extremely dehydrated, emaciated, those type of conditions that we can physically see, or based on doing some lab work, we can determine that there may be some problems, and then we can just decide which route to take on caring for that animal.
I've seen cases reported on Animal Cops Houston that are absolutely extraordinary, where it seemed the animal had no hope at all, absolutely none, and you brought that animal back to life, and the animal was then adopted.
Yes, we've had many situations, and you know, not all of them have been aired on Animal Planet, but we do see these animals come in every day, these animals that are wanting a second chance at life, and we're here to provide that second chance for them. Animals that are basically on death's door come to us, and we try to do the best we can based on the animal's condition at the point that they arrive to the shelter.
The television show indicates that you work very closely with the Animal Police of Houston. How does this partnership work?
Yeah, we work very closely with the Harris County Constable Precinct 1. We have a working partnership with them for many years. And how it works is one of our cruelty investigators will go out to a reported location, and on site, if the investigator determines that there is animal cruelty and neglect going on, we contact the Harris County Precinct 1. Constable deputy goes out there, and that officer is the one who applies for a warrant, where we in turn go and seize the animal from the property, and then we start caring for them properly, and then we end up taking those owners to court.
Does it work or extend throughout Texas? Are you called to other areas, other cities?
Yes, we do get frequent calls to respond to other areas of Texas. What we try to do in those situations, we try to work with law enforcement in those areas and try to work with them and educate them, or just go out and do a visit with them and have them try to take care of the situation themselves. Like you said earlier, our resources are limited. So we really try to focus within Harris County and the surrounding counties.
Tell me a bit about your disaster assistance program, which I know is quite fantastic. Alerted to an unfolding disaster, what immediate steps do you take?
Well, we are part of the Disaster Animal Management Task Force here in Harris County. So we are immediately alerted if there is any disaster or any type of situation happening related to disasters. Here we immediately put staff on alert. We start setting teams up. We always have a primary team that will respond, and then a backup team to replace the first team that went out. We start coordinating all our disaster equipment and getting that in order, and we also start notifying our staff and volunteers that a situation may be developing and that we may need their assistance.
How do you handle multiple disasters? Where do you get the manpower?
If there's multiple disasters, we normally try to decide which disaster is going to affect us immediately, which one is going to have the most effect, the most impact in our area, and that's where we try to focus our resources. in the event that we are responding to multiple disasters, then we really try to rely on volunteers, or we request the assistance of other agencies, other humane societies or other SPCAs, whether locally or across the country, to come down and help us.
So actually, there's no disaster that you can't handle.
At this point, no. Our staff, or especially our field services staff, is highly trained. They're trained in swift water rescue and animal CPR, in close confinement, incline rescues. We go through monthly extensive field training just to keep those individuals sharp and available to respond at a moment's notice.
I'd like to end this session with going back to the cruelty issue, if I might, just for a moment. And that is that when I'm watching it on TV, it seems that the courts, and not only in Texas, but across the country, are often reluctant to send owners to jail, and most cases appear to be handled only with fines. Is this an accurate picture, or is it accurate for Texas? And what steps are required for the SPCA to immediately remove an animal? I see that the owner must sign a form agreeing to the release, but if he doesn't do so, what happens next?
Okay. Going with the first one about an owner going to jail, there's a lot that happens behind the scenes that Animal Planet doesn't film on these owners going to jail or facing criminal charges. After the animal is removed from the owner's custody, there's a civil hearing held within 10 days after the removal of that animal. At that point, it's determined whether the animal is given back to the owner or it's kept at the custody of the Houston SPCA. After the civil hearing, then we file criminal charges with the prosecutor. And at that point, the prosecutor determines what type of criminal action to pursue. And it could be fines and or jail time, depending on the severity of the situation. And then going back with how these animals are taken from the owner, when we arrive at a location and we see the conditions of the animal, we'll determine if the animal is it's in distress, the animal is dying, or the animal is in immediate danger. We'll call a Harris County constable from Precinct 1, and with the investigator and the constable deputy, we'll determine if it warrants that animal needs to be removed immediately. And then we'll just seek a warrant and take the animal out, and then we'll give the owner a notice to appear in court at a certain date.
George, I want to thank you. This has just been an absolutely excellent overview, and I really appreciate your time. I know you're all so busy, and thank you very much as we move to Roberta Westbrook.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Hi, Roberta. Roberta, you're one of the chief veterinarians at the Houston SPCA. Would that be correct?
Yes, I'm one of the staff veterinarians here.
And can you share the highlights of your professional background?
Well, I graduated from the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. That's where I got my doctorate of veterinary medicine. Following that, I spent 4 years in a small animal private practice. And after those years, I decided that I wanted to do something new and I wanted to branch out. And so I decided to come experience shelter medicine, and it's been a great experience.
What do you specialize in?
Well, I specialize in small animal and companion animal medicine. That means dogs, cats, rabbits, and other small rodents, and even birds.
Do you operate on every physical abused animal?
Well, the good news is that every abused animal doesn't necessarily require surgical intervention. A lot of them may just need extensive medical treatment, for example, oral antibiotics or IV fluids. So not all of them require surgery, but on the ones where surgery is required and we're able to do it, we do our best to do those surgeries.
How does the SPCA determine whether and which resources should be invested to save the life of an abused animal?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the extent of the injury. Unfortunately, we get some animals in that have been so badly abused that it takes too much to get them back to a good quality of life where they would make a good pet for someone. And in those unfortunate cases, we are unable to save some of them, and that's the tragedy here. On the flip side of that, we really try to pinpoint which animals
can be saved, given their injuries and given their quality of life after they undergo treatment, whether it be surgery or medical related.
I've seen cases where you actually do save an incredibly injured animal, but thereafter, based on the healing process, have to come to the sad determination that the animal will not live a happy life.
Absolutely, and that's the tragedy of it. You know, when you get an abused animal in, you really try to do your best to save them. And unfortunately, in some cases, we can do everything in our power, and the animal may be too far gone. And those are the unfortunate cases, and we hate when that happens. And that's why we'd like to do a better job on educating the community on what abuse is and how to recognize it and how to prevent it early.
How many vets do you have on staff to do this work?
We have 4 full-time veterinarians on staff right now and a host of technicians and volunteers.
Do any of the volunteers help the technicians directly?
At this time, the volunteers' major help to us is in aftercare, after the doctors, the veterinarians, and the technicians. After we stabilize an animal, after we get its treatment instituted, the volunteers really help us in foster care. So a lot of these animals need to be in a home where they can get constant attention, where they can get medicated on a regular basis. And in those cases, it's best for those animals to be in a more comfortable environment like somebody's home. And volunteers help us extensively and greatly in that capacity. And we're grateful to our volunteers for doing that.
What are the most frequent types of injuries that you see? As you mentioned, embedded collars or broken limbs, is it starvation?
Absolutely. All those things that you mentioned are extremely common. Most of the dogs and cats and even horses that we get in from abuse cases tend to be very underweight. So starvation or lack of proper nutrition is a very common finding. In terms of dogs, embedded collars is very common. We see where most dogs have been left outside with chains around their necks or very thick collars. And those chains and collars have been left on for months to years, and as the dog grows, those chains and collars become embedded into their skin. Or we see dogs and cats that may have been injured, hit by a car, or physically abused, and they may have broken bones and been left without any treatment for those broken bones. And so their bones may have been healed abnormally. They may be disfigured. And those are the most common things that we see. It never gets easy to see those things.
I'm always amazed when I see an animal with an embedded collar, and as you just said, left for months or even years outside, chained to a fence.
Mm-hmm.
How do we absorb this level of stupidity on the part of human beings? How do we deal with it in our own minds?
Yes, it is very difficult to wrap your mind around that, and I think it begins early with education and respect for animals. I think too frequently we see people with just ignorance, not realizing that animals have lives, that these are lives, and that they depend on us for their well-being, and that they can be hurt, and they can feel bad just like other human beings can. And so when we disregard the respect for animals and we disregard the fact that they feel any pain or disregard the fact that they can endure suffering, then I think that's where it becomes a problem. I think we have to realize that animals definitely deserve respect and that it's up to us to give it to them because they can't demand it themselves. We have to be the ones to take care of them. We have to be the ones to provide for them. We have to be the ones to protect them and make sure that they're safe.
Just as an add-on to that, I'm often amazed that the person even bothers to have an animal if they're going to leave them outside with a collar stuck around their neck and they can't move. Why do they keep them?
Absolutely. It's, again, I think respect. I think there are people in the community that may see their dog as just a dog and maybe a dog just to protect their property rather than a dog that needs their loving care, rather than a dog that needs their constant attention, rather than a dog that needs to be taken care of properly. And it goes back to education early on, and it's really difficult to understand that. After being here over a year, I still have a hard time understanding that. And I don't know how to wrap my mind around it, but what I can do is try to educate people and try to prevent it in the first place. I don't know that I'll ever understand the mentality of people who do this to their animals, and I don't want to understand it. What I want to do is prevent it in the first place and do something about those animals that come in here that we can help.
Dogs often appear so amazingly resilient. Is it harder to save the life of a cat as compared to a dog?
I don't think so. I think cats are amazingly resilient as well. It's amazing the injuries that we'll see here, and even in cats that have been hit by cars and have broken legs, or maybe they have limbs that have been caught in traps and have severe injuries. And those cats are still purring, and those cats are still wanting love and affection, and those cats aren't showing any evidence of pain. And so it's amazing what dogs and cats can endure. And I think it's just their instinct to tough it out. And I'll never be surprised at how well these animals come through their injuries.
Can you tell when an animal is in pain, or is there a threshold where they absolutely can no longer hide their pain?
Absolutely. I definitely think some of it is individual. There's some animals that are more sensitive than others. You know, puppies may be a little bit more sensitive than the adult dog that's had more experience in life, and so puppies may be a little bit more sensitive. But the signs of pain are pretty common all across the board. They may have an increased respiratory rate. They may be breathing very fast. They may cry out in pain when they're handled. And some animals, instead of crying out in pain, become very stoic. They may be in pain, but they just don't show it. They're almost in shock. And so as a veterinarian and even our technicians, we begin to recognize those signs of pain, and we can treat those as necessary.
What do you find most heartbreaking about the cases you see?
The most heartbreaking cases are definitely those ones where, as hard as we tried, we've gotten there too late. The amount of abuse has gone on too long. The animal is suffering, and they're not good candidates to treat. Those are the most heartbreaking cases, and it's really difficult to see those animals. It'll never get easy from that perspective.
Well, what do you find most heartwarming?
Well, obviously the opposite of that would be those animals that we have gotten to in time. Those animals that we have rescued, that we have taken out of their poor environment, that we've given them a nice place to stay, that we found them a foster home, that we found them a good, loving, adoptive family. Those are the most heartwarming cases, and the ones that you'll never, ever forget. And those are the ones that we strive to achieve every time we get an animal into the shelter.
You know what I find saddest is that, as you may know, I do a lot of work on homeowner rights, and especially people in condos, and there are 60 million people who live in condo and homeowners associations, and those in condos are largely prevented from owning pets, not all, but the majority across the country. It's a big problem, and yet, imagine if those 40 amongst the 60, perhaps 40 million are in condos, imagine if they could foster a pet. Yesterday I went to our local pet store and asked if I might help, and they said, we need help fostering these animals. And I said, well, I'm in a condo. I can't take it in. It's very sad, isn't it?
It is. Fostering is a great help to us. We have so many animals in the shelter, hundreds, that have been here for weeks or maybe months, or animals that are undergoing treatment, and it would be such a wonderful help to us to be able to get those animals into a foster home where they can be closely watched day and night, and where they can get a chance to be out of the shelter, where they can get a chance to be in somebody's home. Somebody can work with them behavior-wise. Somebody can treat them, give them their medication, and they can begin to become good adoptive pets for families.
It argues for much more compassionate condo rules, even towards fostering rather than owning. If you don't want the person to own, that's one thing, but let them foster.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think that would be a great help. And for responsible pet owners, I think it's a great idea. I wish that one day that could be changed. It could be a great help to us.
I wanted to ask you a final question here, and that is, do you have all the necessary medical equipment in-house that you need, or is this a constant problem? Do you wish people could do more to help you upgrade your equipment?
Well, right now we have some great equipment. We have x-ray machines. We have anesthetic machines. We have things to do fracture repairs and extensive surgeries. Our main need right now would be a blood work machine. We are unable to run blood work in-house, and so anytime an animal might have a systemic disease or disease that we need to monitor the blood values, we have to send that blood out, and it can be a turnaround time of anywhere from 24 to 48 hours. And so sometimes that can be a stressor on us because we'd like to know immediately what's going inside, what's going on inside this animal's body. So having a blood work machine would be a wonderful thing.
And
we're working on that through donations through the community and through even some of the medical organizations. So that's one thing that we would love to have.
How much does a blood work machine cost?
Excuse me?
How much would such a machine cost? What is
The blood work machine can cost several hundred dollars, and it doesn't seem like very much, but we have lots of costs here, lots of medical costs, and it can be hard to stretch our funds to buy such a machine. But there's lots of ranges. We could probably get one for several hundred dollars. Expensive machines may be a few thousand dollars. But we just need the basics here. And so several hundred dollars doesn't seem like very much if it's going to mean us being able to save a life.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you for this excellent interview, Roberta. You really helped me understand what you do a little bit better, and I'm so appreciative that you've shared it with our audience, and thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And now we're moving to Debbie Mitchell, who's Operations Manager of the Wildlife Rehab and Education Center of the Houston SPCA. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, how are you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing great.
I understand that you share responsibilities also for disaster assistance, is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Can you explain a little bit about what you do as the operations manager?
Well, as the operations manager, I help to run the center. Our wildlife center, we take in injured and orphaned Texas native wildlife. So if an animal is injured, then we take care of its medical needs, and we provide a quiet, stress-free environment for it to heal. If we have an animal who is orphaned, then we do our best to place it with other babies its age. We raise them together and allow them a quiet place to eat and grow. Then we try to make sure that they're all released together. We also do a lot of education. We educate children as well as adults. We do school groups and we do scout troops. And we do a lot of talking each day on the telephone to educate the adults. We do our best to try to stress the respect of wildlife, to respect environment, and to respect each other because it all goes hand in hand.
You just mentioned that you do a lot of talking on the phone. How does that come about? You determine that people should receive a call or they're calling you, or how does that work?
Well, we have people that call daily, and they want to know what to do if they find a baby bird, what to do if they find an injured adult or a mammal, like a baby squirrel, or many times they find a mother opossum in the middle of the street who's been hit by a car or a dog has gotten a hold of her. And since we live in such a heavy populated area, our animals tend to come in contact a lot with people and cars. They fly into windows. Dogs will get a hold of them. And one of our biggest issues will be cats, because the cats go after our baby birds, and it's always people call in and they want to know, well, what do I do if I found this baby bird? I'm afraid the cat's going to get it, or a cat has already gotten hold of it.
Do they bring it to you then?
Yes, ma'am, they do.
Do you go out and get it? I mean, you do both, right?
Well, at this point, we do not have the manpower to be able to go out and pick up, so we instruct the people over the phone how to put the animal in a box with a towel or a rag, put the lid on the box so it gives it the most stress-free temporary environment that we can offer it, and then for them to please get them to us as soon as they can.
What are the most common reasons you see animals brought to your center? What are the majority of cases, if there is such a thing?
Well, really, with the baby birds, or even with the birds, the most common thing are the cats. because we have so many cats that are outside, and they want to chase a baby bird. I mean, that's very instinctive for them to do, but they do want to chase our baby birds, our little fledglings that come out of the nest, which they're doing, what they're supposed to be doing as a teenager, learning how to fly and hunt for food, and the cats want to chase them, and a cat will get a hold of them. So we get a lot of little baby birds that the cats have gotten a hold of. We get a lot of our birds and mammals that have been hit by cars. And then our opossums, our adult opossums, they're in our neighborhood. So we have a lot of cases to where dogs will get a hold of a mother opossum and kill the mother. And then we get in like a litter of babies up to 13.
Oh, my Lord. What do you do with 13 opossums?
Well, we raise them. We little baby opossums, they need special care. They have to be fed a special way. And we raise them all to the best of our ability, and we get them all released. And we try to release them out in areas that are away from cars and people, get them out into some good natural habitat so that they can have a good life.
The Wildlife Rehab and Education Center, is that specific to the Houston SPCA, because it seems to me quite unique across the country. I'm not aware that this exists in many other Houston SPCAs.
Well, we used to do this out of our home. We were all volunteers, and we worked out of our homes, and the Houston SPCA would take in the wildlife here at the center for many, many years, and we would have volunteers that would drive over each day, pick up the animals that had come in that day, and then disperse them amongst the volunteers. But the Houston SPCA saw that we had a need, and they wanted to help all animals, not just the dogs and cats and horses and the domestic animals, but they wanted to help all animals. So they were generous enough to offer us a place here with them, and we now have we're an affiliate of the Houston SPCA, and we have our own wildlife center. And we have our state and our federal permits for our center. So these are all protected species that we deal with.
Well, what are the most important steps that can be taken to preserve wildlife, the type of wildlife that you're dealing with? What would you like the listeners to know?
I would like for them to know to please be tolerant of our wildlife. Be tolerant of our opossums and our raccoons and our squirrels and our birds. These creatures were here first, and our homes and our buildings and roads and things have kind of moved in on their habitat. So we need to learn how to coexist together. Be tolerant of them and just sit back and enjoy them. They're great creatures to watch and enjoy. They have a purpose here. Our opossums, for one thing, they eat mice and rats and snakes, even poisonous snakes. So they're great to have in our neighborhoods, and if people would just learn to be a little bit more tolerant of them and enjoy them, they can, as far as the habitat in our neighborhoods, they can offer trees, they can offer shrubs for these animals. I like to have the plants in my yard that provide food and shelter for butterflies and hummingbirds. It attracts them to my yard. It's a good thing to have some fresh water out in your yard, clean water for any of the wildlife that passes through to give them a drink. It's good to have out your bird feeders and make sure they're kept clean so that there's not disease that's spread between the birds.
So, in other words, instead of the view that by putting water down or putting a little bit of food down, you might attract a population that comes and never leaves, your view is, no, they're passing through and they need something to eat. Be a good neighbor?
I think so. Our birds are migratory, so they pass through. Opossums, they will, if you just offer them some water, they're going to pass through. Opossums generally do not stay in one spot long. Now, if you keep dog and cat food out, that's kind of like a little free grocery store for them, so they will kind of hang around and eat. But if you just keep fresh water out for passing wildlife that goes through, our birds will use the water, our opossums, raccoons, anything that goes through, but we do need to keep it clean.
We've done a show on feral cats. It was a wonderful show, and how you can help feral cats. Is that a problem that you're dealing with directly?
Yes, we deal a lot with feral cats because the feral cats do a lot of damage to our birds. The feral cats will not bother a raccoon. They will not bother an opossum or a squirrel generally. They do, your feral cats will get a hold of our baby squirrels. Occasionally an adult squirrel, it depends on how big a feral cat it actually is, if they can tangle with an adult squirrel. But the feral cats do a lot of damage to our bird population. And if we could keep our cats inside, keep them safe from disease and cars, and that would help our bird population.
Well, that's more reason for adoptions or neutering of feral cats. And
oh, absolutely.
Trying to take them off the streets, not by eliminating them, but by finding them homes.
Right.
And stopping the reproduction.
Right. If we could spay and neuter, that would help tremendously.
Well, Debbie, I want to thank you so much for introducing us to your amazing Wildlife Rehab and Education Center and for being with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
I want to introduce now Elise Gouge, and she is an animal behavior specialist.
Good morning, Elise. Dr. Starr.
How are you?
I'm doing excellent. How are you doing this morning?
Okay. Well, teaching those animals a new form of behavior, now that's a challenge.
It's a lot of fun.
And can you tell us a little bit, give us an overview of what you do every day?
Sure. We do many things. We offer in-shelter services, and then we offer a lot of services to the public. So for the in-shelter services, we do a lot of behavior evaluations on the dogs that are in the shelter and any other species, cats, horses, anything that's in the shelter, to determine their behavioral adoptability. We also train all of the staff. We train the vet techs, the animal care staff, the adoption counselors, all on proper handling of the animals, just all the proper ways that we should be discussing animals with the public, working with the public, handling the actual animals, cleaning the cages. I mean, you name it, we help them out here in the shelter. As far as the public goes, we do a tremendous amount of work offering group classes and private consultations for people that are having an animal in the home that's got some behavior problems, and they're really committed to keeping the animal in the home, and they just need some help knowing which direction to go in.
How many animal behavior specialists do you have on staff?
We have two behaviorists on staff, and then we have a wonderful group of interns that are so generous with their time, and they generally, they will be here for approximately 200 hours every month, donating their time to evaluating dogs in the shelter, behavior consulting with people in the public, and teaching group classes.
They're interns for animal behavior, for the animal behavior degree, or what are they interning for?
They are interning specifically for animal behavior. They are working towards their certification to become a pet dog trainer, which is a fairly rigorous set of standards in order to pass an exam. And they need to have 300 hours of teaching under their belt, as well as some other things. So they're quite motivated, and it's actually a fabulous program. If you went anywhere else in the country, you would have to pay thousands of dollars for this type of education. And at the Houston SPCA, we're so committed to having it be a reciprocal relationship that we offer all of this free of charge, in the sense that the reciprocity comes with them being able to volunteer their time to doing the things that are so needed and so important in the behavior department.
I know that you have a long list of initials after your name.
MBA,
CDBC, CPDP. What does all that mean? It sounds so impressive.
My original degree was in Master's in Public Health, and Master's in Public Health is really a fabulous degree that centers on systems, and it's really about how one thing affects another. And as random as it might seem to working in a field like animal welfare, you would be amazing at how crucial it is, because if you think about a shelter system and how we interface with the public, you're talking about so many different sort of systems, the systems of the vet techs. Everybody has their own little world, basically. And everybody has their own little bubble. And being able to have all those bubbles come together and coexist in a way that's functional and really helping us to be as successful as possible is crucial. And so I have a tremendous amount of experience in having those areas overlap and making it work. So that's my master's degree. And then after that, the CPDT is a certification as a pet dog trainer. And that's an individual certification through a board that is the same type of board as you would get certified to be a public accountant, like a CPA, and except for pet dog training. And we also have the certification to be a dog behavior consultant, and that's a little bit of a higher ranking certification, which is very rare. There's actually only two, I believe, in Houston, and very few in the state of Texas in general. So it's a pretty elite certification to have, and we're very happy that we can have a behaviorist here at the Houston SPCA that has that.
Well, that's an amazing insight. Excellent. I'm very happy to hear, because we don't know about that. We see animal behaviorists on TV, so we have no idea of the amount of training that goes into that level of excellence.
Yes, and unfortunately, anybody can hang their shingle out and say that they are an animal behaviorist or an animal specialist, and the lack of qualifications and the lack of rigor that goes into researching their experience is very sad, I consider. I mean, you would never hire a plumber, you would never hire a therapist without researching their credentials, and but unfortunately, in the world of animal behavior, they're just not as widely known. So anything that we can do to really publicize that and get that information out so that people are ending up not hiring an inexperienced person that's not using the current progressive methods of behavior modification, anything that we can do in that area to prevent that from happening, because that just creates more damage.
Well, I hope we can help.
So anything we can do would be helpful.
Right. Now, you do some fun things, too.
Certainly.
You do...
It's all fun.
Well, that's right. But I understand you do something that's really unusual, and that's kitten kindergarten.
I love kitten kindergarten.
Tell us about kitten kindergarten.
Kitten kindergarten is so fabulous, and I have to say that, you know, I can't tell you how many people come in the shelter, and they see kitten kindergarten, and they laugh. They just laugh. And I have to think... You know, I understand that it's a little funny to look at, but it is such a fabulous class. It's 3 weeks long, and in those 3 weeks, your kittens learn how to play with other kittens. They learn how to scratch the right things instead of scratching your furniture. They learn how to be handled. They learn how to have their nails clipped. They learn how to, you know, be brushed and groomed. They learn how to not eat your hands and instead eat their toys. I mean, it's just, I don't, you know, everybody should do it. It's 3 weeks long. It's 1 hour each week. And it's so, I mean, the price is so low. And, I mean, it's just great. So
it sounds adorable.
It's full of fun. It's full of play. And it's full of incredibly interesting information. Not to mention that you have a highly qualified trainer there that can answer all your questions about, well, why is my cat not use the litter box this week? Or why is my cat, you know, not getting along with my dog? Or why won't my cat accept my resident cat? So all of that is just very helpful to address in kitten kindergarten.
Do the kitten moms and dads stay for the kindergarten, or they leave the cat?
Oh, yes. Yes, they definitely do. They come in, they participate, they've got to learn how to do all these things so they can replicate it at home. So, yes, they do it. And, of course, we also teach tricks, because what class would be complete without tricks?
I understand you're very good at that. You've got a cat that can shake hands?
Yeah, we can teach cats. Teaching a cat to shake hands is pretty much, you can do that in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
It's very, very easy. There are some precursors to being able to do it, but once you have them able to have some foundation behaviors down, like targeting, which is where they would hit their paw to your hand. And you can train that to do them very quickly, because every time they touch their paw to your hand, you give them a treat. And then very quickly, obviously, you can translate that into them sticking their hand out to shake paws with you.
Can you train a difficult dog or cat to be more adoptable?
You definitely can. I would say that, I mean, almost 100% of our people that come in from the public are calling because they've reached some behavior problem with their dog, and they really, really want a way to make keep the dog in the house and make it more adoptable, or the cat. And so most of our behavior consultations are around how can we keep this animal in the home and keep harmony and keep everybody happy. So you definitely can train a difficult cat or dog to be more adoptable.
Are dogs more easily adopted than cats, or the reverse?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are dogs more easily adopted than cats, or the reverse?
I would say it's the same. I haven't seen a big disparity in between the two.
You know, you bring up a very interesting subject, and that is that so many pet owners give up a pet, and the pet ends up on the street.
Right.
But that's out of frustration over a particular behavior.
Right.
Yet if they had access to your little kindergarten or to the other services that you offer, they might keep the pet happily for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but yet you're unusual. What you're doing down at the Houston SPCA is not being done across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Are there such little kindergartens, and are there other animal behaviors at other SPCAs? Is this the future, or is it still very unique?
Well, it's hard for me to say about the national trend of animal behavior in shelters. I would say that over the past 10 years, shelters have taken a very different direction in terms of where they're assigning their values. And there is an enormous commitment to eliminating the overpopulation program. And as we reduce our overpopulation issue, it'll come up more and more. Well, what are we going to do with the dogs that we do have? The North is already facing this, where they don't have many dogs in their kennels, so they kind of have to work with what they've got, which basically necessitates that the staff become educated and savvy around behavior so that they are able to rehabilitate and work with those dogs to make them adoptable, and cats.
And what about horses? Is it particularly difficult to retrain an abused horse, especially in such a relatively short time?
You would be amazed at how forgiving animals are. They're just such a beautiful, beautiful creatures in terms of their ability to forgive and move ahead. And most of our horses that come in have been severely neglected, and, of course, some of them have been abused. But most of what goes on with them is that they have never had the experience of feeling safe with a person and having a person be able to interact with them and touch them and be with them in a way that's comfortable and safe. And so a lot of it is just moving slowly and helping them get used to what they need to learn how to do in a way that's at their pace.
Well, this has just been wonderful. Elise, I want to thank you so much for your excellent introduction to animal behavior and kitten kindergarten and all that you're doing to save animals and protect them. It's just amazing and wonderful.
Can I pipe in with one thing that you were talking earlier about with Dr. Westbrook?
Absolutely.
You had asked about condo people fostering, which is an excellent help. And doing one of the things that the behavior department does is we do outreach where we would go to condo associations and talk to them, and we would educate them about what it means to have foster pets in their condo association, what the implications are, what kind of support we could offer them, and really educate them so that they're not operating under any fallacies about what it would mean. And that's one thing that I would love if we did more of, because then, like you said, we would be able to create situations where people were more receptive to fostering and helping us with the tremendous amount of overpopulation that we have.
I fought a 2-year condo battle over my cat, and the condo's effort to rid this condo of the cat. It was a landmark case, one in Florida, and it took 2 years of my life.
Wow.
So I know how harsh these condo associations can be.
Mm-hmm.
And anything you can do to educate them and anything I can do to help you, I'd be more than happy to do it.
Yep, and we're always on board. And if anything comes up, you're always welcome to contact Mira, and she can get in touch with me. And, just know that the Houston SPCA is not locked into staying at the Houston SPCA. We go out, we work with vets in the community, we work with people just to help them. So, you know, anything we can do around that, I just wanted to let you know that that's also a service that we offer.
I think it's a national service that you're providing, really.
A national service?
Yeah, you're providing a national service because if you're educating people in Houston, you're implicitly educating people across the nation.
Yep, yep. And we do national phone consultations as well for people with animals. So we do national service as well. So
well, that's just
it's all good.
Elise, again, I want to thank you. And we're going to turn it back to Mira now.
Okay, great. Thank you so much
all
for your
right.
time. Have a good day.
Thank you. Mira?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Well, we have just a few more minutes, and I want to commend your the resources and the people, expertise that you brought to the table today. It's been just remarkable.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that they were all so helpful. I actually learned a few things myself today.
Would you have any follow-up comments based on some of the discussions that we had? Anything that you'd like to add in particular?
Well, I want to say that with all the work we do here, there's 120 employees, about that many at the Houston SPCA, but we also have over 500 volunteers who logged 47,000 hours in 2007. Those are people who donate their time to help animals, and I think that they really should be commended for all the efforts that they put in to make sure that these animals are really just taken care of in every which way, from sheltering to food. There are people who come here to walk the dogs and play with the animals and just spend time with them and make sure that, you know, they're taken care of until they do get adopted.
I think that's a wonderful point because I discovered yesterday in my own inquiries here in my community that you had that option as a volunteer to play with the animals. And I think people would find that quite reinforcing and fulfilling. Playing with animals.
Yeah, there was a lady actually yesterday. There was a little dog who came in, and he's a cute little terrier mix, and he was just scared. It was his first day here, and she wanted to take him for a walk, and he was just a little scared. So she just sat and played and talked with him, and finally he was able to go for his walk. And it's just, it's really sweet to see because they loosen up after a little bit, but when they first get to here, you know, they're a little scared. It's a different environment than walking around on the street, you know?
Absolutely. Overall, the work of the Houston SPCA is simply remarkable and so to be commended. And I hope the people who hear this show will pick up their phone and help you in any way that you need help. Can you again share your website address and telephone numbers and contact details?
Yes. Our website is HoustonSPCA.org. Our number is 713-869-7722. My extension is 138. And, of course, when you call, it prompts you to the correct extension to call. And we're open 7 days a week from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. And we're here to answer your questions about behavior, about, you know, if you want to donate, if you want to volunteer. And we have all that information as well on our website, plus a little bit more. So I hope
you
do log on.
Events coming up, anything that you want people to know about in 2009 coming up?
Well, for 2009, you know, we have these set in stone sort of events, and coming up here in October is our Mutt Strut, and it's a lot of fun. It raises quite a bit of money for the Houston SPCA, and it's where you can run or walk with your dog at Bush Intercontinental Airport at the runway where the planes are, and it's a lot of fun. And, again, we're hoping to surpass our goal from last year. We raised over $120,000 last year. And, of course, all that money goes to benefit the animals here, providing shelter, food, and medical care. And, of course, we have our annual gala. It's called the Paparazzi this year, and it's on November 1st. It's a very spectacular event. And, again, all the money raised goes to helping the animals here at the Houston SPCA. We also have luncheons that we do, and those are also quite a big deal. Those are usually in the spring. But we have, you know, and our annual telethon is huge. We have a 5-hour telethon every year. Like I said, we had our last one August 23rd, and it raised over $300,000 in 5 hours. And on that day, we actually did something very special. It was called our adoption stimulus package, and all you could have adopt 2 canines, 2 felines, and 2 rabbits at no cost as long as you were an approved adopter. And it was we got to do that in part by Hill Science Diet kind of jumping in there and helping us out with that. And on that day, 281 animals found homes.
Oh, just wonderful.
Yeah, it is. And after that, of course, you have this spill of people still coming in, you know, after the telethon. And, you know, it's been really great.
Well, Mira, I want to thank you for this extraordinary program and all of your efforts. We have well over 30 emails back and forth between us and the coordination of this show, which is, I think, one of the best that we've done, if not the best, and certainly so detail-oriented and factual. You're absolutely terrific, and I appreciate your efforts.
Well, we appreciate you thinking of us, and we've really enjoyed being on your show.
Okay. Well, this is Dr. Joyce Starr with Rights Radio, Your Right to Know, and please join us for our next show.